Let's do a look at our sermon text then. Again, Matthew chapter 7, verses 13 to 27. Recognize we've got a lot of words in the service this morning, so hang in there. Lots of great words. So let me read these to you. This is the end of the Sermon on the Mount, and it's the end of the Sermon on the Mount series. So you might be at a little bit of a disadvantage this morning if you haven't been, you know, walking with me all the way through this, but hopefully not too much. We'll do what we can. Matthew 7 says, "Enter by the narrow gate. For the gate is wide and the way is easy that leads to destruction, and those who enter by it are many. For the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few. Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. You will recognize them by their fruits. Are grapes gathered from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? So every healthy tree bears good fruit, but the diseased tree bears bad fruit. A healthy tree cannot bear bad fruit, nor can a diseased tree bear good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Thus you will recognize them by their fruits. Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven, but the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. On that day many will say to me, 'Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and cast out demons in your name and do many mighty works in your name?' And then I will declare to them, 'I never knew you. Depart from me, you workers of lawlessness.' Everyone then who hears these words of mine and does them will be like a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain fell and the floods came and the winds blew and beat on that house, but it did not fall because it had been founded on the rock. And everyone who hears these words of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell. And great was the fall of it." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. So some time back, I was online and ended up through some, you know, those kind of news links that you all of a sudden you end up someplace you never thought you're, you know, like, what am I doing here? Because I was watching a TED Talk. You know what a TED Talk, everybody know what a TED Talk is? These little, you know, little videos or talks that kind of, something about this, the convergence of, I think it's technology and entertainment and design, I think is what it is. I read that online, so anyway. So I'm watching this TED Talk, and the presenters had this really, to me, fascinating idea to help solve the traffic problem in Austin, Texas. Doesn't that sound amazingly enticing to you? Okay, I thought it was interesting. And here's the thing. So Austin, Texas has a dramatic traffic issue. So these TED talkers, I guess, they had come up with a design to create a system, this network of elevated cable pods, kind of like glorified ski lifts, that ran along existing traffic ways to create public transportation. And according to this TED Talk, the implementation and upkeep costs would be exponentially lower than anything else. And not only that, the customer use, convenience would be far higher. The environmental impact would be far less invasive because they're using existing passageways. It was really fascinating. I found it really, really fascinating, as you can tell. So I watched it, and I was enamored by it, and I thought about it, and you know what I did next? Nothing. It has not changed my life in any way. I turned off the computer and I went back to whatever I was doing, probably writing a sermon or something like that. It was totally fascinating, really engaging. I mean, the presenters were amazing. And it has not in any way affected at all the trajectory of my life. It was very interesting. But I clearly did not think that the TED Talk was a life or death kind of a scenario. I kind of wonder at the end of the Sermon on the Mount when Jesus gets to these last four illustrations. He's wrapping up the whole sermon with these last four illustrations. We said last week that this command to love is a summary of the Sermon on the Mount. And here he gets like his final swing at this. These four illustrations. I wonder if the crowd, I wonder how they responded to what Jesus had been talking about. Maybe more importantly, I wonder what we're going to do, having endured several weeks of Sermon on the Mount with me preaching it. I wonder what we're going to do, having heard Jesus talk about the kingdom life and what it means to be identified with Christ and what that looks like. I wonder what our response will be. Because the truth is, we can be honest, Jesus is an expert preacher. Like, that's kind of a, obviously, it's kind of a truism. Jesus is an amazing preacher. He's an expert at illustrative language. As a preacher, you know, I fancy myself some kind of a preacher, at least, serviceable perhaps. But I love language, and I read this and I think, wow, this is amazing language. It's compelling, it's penetrating. But it might also be easy for us to read these words of Jesus, hear the sermon, and then turn around and not recognize the life or death implications of them. Easy to read these amazing, compelling words and then go, wow, that was fascinating. What's for dinner? So here we are at the end of Jesus' sermon. He's calling us to pay attention to what he's been saying and to respond accordingly. Because as we see in these four illustrations, this message that Jesus has been preaching about the kingdom and what it means to be identified with the Messiah, it's not small potatoes. It's not a fascinating TED talk. It is actually life or death. To ignore Jesus' words is for us to live numb or oblivious to our own self-destructive futility. What will we do with what Jesus says? Well, what I want to do this morning is take a look at this final piece of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. Look at these four illustrations. And just to give you a sense of where we're going, what I hope to do this morning is do this. I want us to look at the structure of the passage, kind of walk through these last four illustrations, see the way that Jesus sort of lays them out, and then maybe we can look at the implications of the passage and maybe present a final choice for us. But let's look at the structure of the passage here. So in order, these last four illustrations, they fall out of this. Jesus presents a summons. So to the people that have been listening, there's a summons. Then there's a warning about being deceived by others, a warning about self-deception, and finally a warning about inaction. Let's take a look at those in turn. First of all, look at the summons in verses 13 to 14. Jesus lays before the hearer two different gates and two different roads. Famous passage. I mean, these are passages that we've all heard before. They've been woven into kind of the fabric of the way we use words and metaphors. But he lays out these two different gates, two different roads. One way is wide and easy. Lots of people on that road. Well-worn path. But then there's this other way that's more constricted, and the trudging is harder, and sometimes it's a little bit lonelier because there just aren't as many people there. And at the outset, we kind of look at that and go, well, which way do you take? Well, the wide way, right? It's way easier. Except that we have to consider where the ways are going. Where do they end? And what Jesus says here is that, yeah, there's this wide, easy way, but it leads to destruction. And yes, there's this rather constricted, more narrow way, this harder way, but it leads to life. So which one makes more sense now? It seems like kind of a goofy thing to say. Take the hard way. It's the one that's going to lead to life. But just for the sake of saying, we have experiences that prove that sometimes the easy way doesn't go as well as we think. It's not completely foreign to us. I was thinking about this. I mean, think about the difference between ending the day. Have you ever had a day where you spend the day doing really good work? For me, that's like digging a hole, you know, something where you're physically engaged and hard work that just feels satisfying. And then you go to bed that night and you just go, oh, rest. And it feels good. But then there are those easier days when you might have a full day of couch-bound football and nacho binging. How does that day end? You know, one way is hard, but it ends in satisfaction. The other way is pretty easy, and it ends in, well, it doesn't end well. We'll just, does not end well. We have experiences that show us that, I mean, what Jesus is saying, it feels atypical, but it's not completely out of our experience. Sometimes the easy way ends up being destructive, and the hard way ends up being satisfying. And Jesus presents that to us here. This question of whether to take the easy road or the hard road, okay, this is way, way bigger stakes than nachos or digging a hole. I'm willing to admit that. Because it's a rather stark question. It's a stark question of whether one is going to live out the kingdom ethic or to not live out the kingdom ethic. To live out the kingdom ethic is to take this hard way that Jesus has presented in the Sermon on the Mount, to truly put it to work, or to live in opposition to Jesus and the kingdom and this way of life. It makes me think of that famous Frost poem that everybody probably, if you think of two roads, a lot of you may, like me, go, ah, two roads diverged in a yellow wood. And knowing I could not travel both and be one traveler, long I stood. There's actually something very similar here. Jesus is saying you can't take both roads. You can't be one traveler on both roads. And Jesus is summoning his followers to what is truly a hard and narrow way. But it's a hard and narrow way that leads to life. His kind of life. Jesus' kind of life. Well, let's move on to the next illustration here that Jesus uses in verses 15 to 20. Jesus has this warning about being deceived by others. Jesus is making the point here that there are those out there that will say things that on the surface sound really appealing. They sound good. They sound like they might make sense, but under the surface is lurking this carnivorous beast just waiting to pounce. That's a rather stark illustration, I think. There are some that will try to pull our attention from the message of Jesus, from the message of Christ, and peddle another version of how to see the world. There are those out there that will do that. And sometimes those people will do that in the name of God Himself. The way to tell the difference, according to Jesus, is to look at the fruit they bear. To look and see, okay, all right, here's someone. Here's a prophet, so to speak, if we think of that analogously. Someone telling me what's true about the world, telling me what's most fundamental, telling me what's the way to life. There are those that will give lots of messages. And Jesus is saying, listen, let me give you this warning about being deceived. Here's the way to tell the difference. Look at the fruit that they bear. By this, I believe that Jesus is pointing to whether or not this prophet, or we can, whatever the analogy of prophet is, this person that's proclaiming a certain message about how the world works and what's true. Jesus says the way to tell if they're a true messenger or a false messenger is to look at their fruit, by which I believe he's pointing to whether or not they're living out the visible kingdom ethic, the things that he's been saying in the Sermon on the Mount up till now. And like the summons in verse 13 and 14 to Jesus, these stakes are very high. Those that are not bearing, those prophets that are not bearing the fruit of the kingdom and are therefore not true prophets, what is their end? It's to be thrown into the fire. It's destruction. It's the end. And I think that this is a very important bit of wisdom for us because we live in an age of profound self-promotion. And perhaps people have always been self-promoting, but now the technology is such that you can really do some self-promotion now. There are lots of people that are out there vying for our attention, lots of people that are willing to tell us how to approach life, how to deal with the world. And Jesus is calling his disciples to a level of discernment that is not based on the flash of the presentation. It's not based on what you see in the big soundbite, but rather looks at what kind of fruit is being borne by this messenger. Do they demonstrate a kingdom-formed life? That's how you tell the difference. That's how you keep from being deceived. Do they bear the fruit of a kingdom-born or a kingdom-formed life? And I would say this is true of anyone seeking to lead us to life, to the good life. It's true of advertisers. It's true of politicians. It's true of friends. It's true of lovers. It's true of cultures, broadly speaking. And it's true, most definitely, of preachers and teachers. Do you want to know if you're being deceived? Do you want to know if they're a true messenger? What kind of fruit does their life bear? See, the narrow way of Jesus leads to life. The wide way of false prophets leads to death. Stakes are high. Let's look at the next illustration, verses 21 to 23. After this summons to the hard and narrow way that leads to life, and after exposing the danger of being deceived by others, Jesus goes on to warn of the danger of self-deception. And these verses, to me, can be really unsettling. Because these are people that were really active. These are people doing really good stuff. I mean, that list of things, I mean, you kind of look at that and go, wow, these people are right on. But it's unsettling because Jesus says, you know what? There's a difference between activity and intimacy. There's a difference between doing stuff that's good and knowing and being known by Christ. You can take on the forms, the outward forms of the kingdom without investing those forms with the knowledge of the King. And that's good for us to remember. It is good for us to remember that in this context, this idea of knowledge, when he says, I never knew you, it's not just talking about intellectual data, information. It's talking about relational knowing, intimacy. Jesus is saying to these people that were doing some really great stuff, okay, but I never knew you. This isn't about being good at Bible trivia or having an encyclopedic knowledge of theological terminology. And similarly, it isn't about knowing all the right causes that kingdom people are supposed to be a part of. It's not about the outward forms here. That's not the same. Knowing those things is not the same as knowing Jesus, knowing the Messiah. To know Jesus is to be identified with him, to follow him, to relate with him. To know Jesus is, you won't be surprised to hear me say, to love him. And that raises the unsettling question for us of whether or not we know Jesus. Am I truly identified with him beyond just the outward forms of, like, you know, showing up, attendance, the habits that we might have had formed in us, sort of moral habits that are good moral habits, but they don't equal knowing Christ? Do I care to know him? Am I fascinated on the surface, but kind of disinterested and disengaged otherwise? It's kind of, to me at least, it's a scary proposition that a person can do lots of things that look really great and still not really know Christ. You know, growing up around Oklahoma, here's my Oklahoma reference for the morning. Growing up around Oklahoma, you can quickly learn that you can have a really lovely looking, I was going to say manufactured home, but I noticed there aren't a lot of those up here, like a mobile home. You can have a really lovely double wide. And it can have a skirt around it that looks like brick, you know, faux brick skirt. You can trim the yard. You can have all kinds. You can have a nice, I was going to say a satellite dish on top, but I guess we don't do that anymore. I'm from Oklahoma. Anyway, you can have a lovely looking place. And if that thing is not locked into a foundation, when the storm comes, you know what's going to happen? It's now a mobile airplane. Right? You can have a lovely looking edifice, but if it's not rooted to a foundation, it will be blown away when the storms come. You can have the ability to talk about all kinds of details about the words of Jesus, but if those words are never put into practice, when the storms come, you won't be able to stand. Jesus is saying here that, well, I should back up. Jesus is saying here, let's move on to 24 to 27 because I skipped our transition to get there. Jesus, in this last final warning, taking all these things into mind in verses 24 to 27, is warning about this issue of inaction. Right? He's given these warnings about deception and self-deception. And he's saying, as in my sort of proleptic use of my own illustration here, Jesus is saying that, listen, you can take all this stuff in. You can hear all these words, but if they never get rooted into action, then when the storms come, all of your great ideas, all of the teachings and tenets of the kingdom that you have floating around inside your brain, it's all going to fall apart unless it gets rooted into the praxis of the kingdom. Often we read this verse and we go, yes, I must be rooted on the rock that is Christ, and that's a true thing to say. This passage, though, that case can be made from other passages. This passage, though, in Jesus' use of this illustration is saying this. If you don't root the teachings into real-life practice, when the storms come, it's all going to fall apart. It will blow away. That lovely double-wide with the big satellite dish on top will fall. And when the storms come, and these great ideas that you've heard, when they don't get connected to the ground, when the storms come, it's going to end in a great and destructive fall. Now, that's a lot to say about the flow of the passage. What are the implications of all this for us? If we keep in mind that Jesus has given this summons and he's talked about the warning of deception, the warning of self-deception, and then finally, though I didn't really help by some of the transitions and the way I'm talking about it, the danger of inaction. So what then? What are the implications? You know, there's a certain kind of divisiveness in Jesus' teaching here. It really is Jesus' way or the highway, or Jesus' way or and the other highway, the wide one. Here at the end of Jesus' sermon, he's calling his disciples to take on the life of the kingdom that he's been espousing over the last few chapters. To really take it on, to put it to work, to get it rooted to the ground, the places where we live. And it is kind of divisive because it's this radical call to unmitigated and an act of allegiance to Jesus. Complete devotion to Christ. But let's not miss that while the call of Christ, it really is this call to utter and complete allegiance, it's also not a capricious, insecure power grab on Jesus' part. Rather, it's the author of life calling a bunch of insecure, self-destructive rebels to return to the glorious life of utter dependence upon him that we are made for. The call of allegiance is a call to the kind of life that the resurrected Christ has won for us by taking our death upon himself, like we've been considering throughout our whole service. It's the call to be identified with the Messiah who won that life for us. The call of the kingdom, it's not this call to like a life of gritty, dogged self-determination. It's not that. It's rather a call to a life of gritty and dogged dependence. Dependence on our Messiah who says, your allegiance belongs with me. And that's the way to life. You see, the call of the kingdom, as stark as it is, it's a call to live. These things that Jesus has been saying in this whole sermon, he's not just burdening us. He's reawakening us to the life that we were made for. Real life, kingdom life, Christ-formed life. So then here at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, we're faced with a choice. Will we act on what Jesus said? Will we hear it and then go do it? To put the things to work. Will we, for example, acknowledge our poverty of spirit? Will we put ourselves in positions to let our light shine and to preserve decay? Will we get honest about the real nature of our sin, even when it's easy to call the things that we know are sin other things? Things that are more culturally respectable. Will we love our enemies instead of trying to justify ourselves and our positions? Will we stop fearfully hoarding our resources and live generously? Will we act on the belief that our Father in heaven actually does love us so we don't have to be anxious? Those are the things that Jesus has been saying, that life of utter dependence upon him. Will we start doing it, enacting it? We could just go, that's a hard way. It's a super hard way. And the only way we'll be able to do it is if we learn to wholeheartedly depend on our Father in heaven who truly loves us. But that's the hard way we're called to. That's the kind of life that we're called to put into practice, this life of dependence upon a Father that loves us so much that he's even willing to tell us this hard way gets you to life. This hard way is the embodiment of all the things that I made you for, created you for. All the things that I sent my son to die for you for so that you could live that way again, to renew this life in you. Jesus is calling us to a hard way, but it's a hard way of dependence that leads to life. Now, I mentioned before that Danielle and I are excited. I'm especially excited planning for our epic 20th wedding anniversary trip to Yellowstone. I love Yellowstone. Have I mentioned that I love Yellowstone? Love Yellowstone. Looking forward to going. We're going to be gone for like more days than I can care to think about because I also love my kids and it's hard to. Anyway, we're going to Yellowstone. It's going to be huge. So that's going to be huge. Sorry, I've been watching too much news. It should. I'm fired. Okay, we're going in May. Perfect season to go, especially to see wildlife, and we're really excited about that because every time I see like a bear or something, my first impulse, I told Josh and Amanda because there's a great dog outside the coffee shop. I just have this impulse that when I see big animals, I just want to hug them. Which is funny because I'm not really a hugger otherwise, but I just want to just like, oh, bears, oh, yes. Anyway, so you'll be glad to know that I've been reading magazines about trails and things like that, and there's this, and I think every single trail book I've read, there's been some kind of a sentence or two that sounds a lot like this. Are you ready? It says, always hike with bear spray and keep 100 meters from bison, bears, wolves, and moose. Remember that Yellowstone is an unpredictable wilderness and that visitors die in the park every year. Now, but I want to see animals. I want to hug a bear. You know, it's a bad idea. But anyway, you know, I don't want to lug around bear spray. I don't want to wear a bell on my backpack. I want to see these animals, right? I don't want to chase them off. I mean, really, 100 meters from bison, I'd like to get close to the bison. If it helps to know, Danielle is also going, and she'll keep us safe. But anyway, the thing is, like, you read this kind of a warning. People die in the park every year, and you're like, oh, man. But you know what? As much as I don't want to be constrained by these crazy instructions about staying away from bison, and, you know, not explicitly saying, but I think it's implied, don't hug the bears. But, you know, I can hear that message, and I can say, oh, I don't want to do that. That's too hard. It doesn't get to where I want to go. Or I can hear the message and put it into practice. One way leads to a less enjoyable version of a bear hug, right? If I don't carry the bear spray, if I meet the bear, if I hug the bear, another visitor will die in the park. The easy way, the unconstrained way, it leads to destruction. But the other way, that has some constraints to it, that has some forms to it, you know what it leads to? It leads to me being able to take in the full grandeur and glory and scenery of this most spectacular place on the planet. You see, the hard way, the constrained way, leads to death. Or the easy way. There goes the whole sermon. The easy way, oh, rhetoric. The easy way, the unconstrained way, leads to destruction. But the harder way, the constrained way, it leads to me being able to fully enjoy the true beauty, the life that is there to be seen. Jesus calls you and me this morning to actually do what he's been saying, to put it into practice, to live out this love-focused, dependent ethic. And it's hard. It is hard. That's true. But it's a hard way that opens up into the life and the grandeur and the glory and the freedom of the life that Christ has won for us in his death and resurrection. And you know what? We can't mince words about it. It is critical that we hear the message of Jesus with all of its weight, but that we don't just hear it, but that we also heed it. You see, the message of Jesus that he's been preaching all through the Sermon on the Mount, it truly is a message of life. So I say for those of us that are identified with him, let's do it. Let's do his word. Let me pray. Father in heaven, thank you that you take in imperfect speakers, clearly. And I pray that the message, though, would be worked into us. Lord, that we would hear this call to dependent love on the Father. And that we'd do it, recognizing that we're going to struggle, we're going to stumble on the hard road. But as those that are dependent upon the Father, we know that you are leading, you are guiding, you are protecting. Lord, I pray that you would, by your Spirit, empower us to start taking more steps down that road so that we might more and more know the life that is there for us. So thank you for your word, Lord. Work it into us, I pray in Jesus' name. Amen.